march of time. Life, the magazine of pictures, is edited to show intelligent American families the news of the week and the ways of the world's people. Life is edited for the families of men like Thomas E. Dewey, famed record-smashing district attorney of New York City. Says Mr. Dewey,
life is not only entertaining and stimulating, life is unbiased and unafraid in presenting important news. It is a great combination of courage and color in picturing American life.
Life is edited for the families of men like Joseph P. Kennedy, newly appointed United States Ambassador to Great Britain. Says Ambassador Kennedy,
life is real and a good deal more than earnest in its vigorous, unbiased presentation of the news. It's marvelous. I look forward to reading it every week.
And it is because life goes into the homes of families like these, today nearly 2 million of the best American families, that many advertisers are predicting that Life, before long, will be not only the most read magazine in the country, but the leading advertising medium.
The new issue of Life is on sale at newsstands tomorrow, and more copies of Life are now being sold on U.S. newsstands each month than of any other magazine. Go to your news dealer. He will just have received his copy. And if you don't see Life, we suggest you ask for it.
Tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, joins Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time. The Philippine Islands. This week in Manila comes the climax of a story which begins on a corner of the Calamba Sugar Estate, bordering the Manila Golf Course, where Filipino washerwoman Dominga Capati is scrubbing clothes as a caddy approaches her.
Hey, did you see a golf ball come out this way?
What? Oh, that little white ball he'll run over there?
Yes. Did you see?
No, I did not. And if you ask me, a sensible people ought to find something better to do with their time than walk around in the hot sun. Hit the ball. Go look for it. Hit it again. Foolishness.
Easy to talk with when you've never tried.
Try it? But if I did, I would hit it harder than those big fat men. Those women with their little thin arms.
You could not even hit the ball.
Oh, you think so, huh? All right. Just put a ball down on the ground there. Go ahead. Put the ball down on the ground. Now, give me one of those sticks. Now, stand back out of my way. There! Now, get along and don't bother me. I've got work to do.
Hey, wait. Let me see you do that again.
Okay.
250 yards. Here, try another.
Two years ago, Husky Dominga Capati swung her first golf club, hit her first golf ball. This week, in the roster of entries in the Manila Women's Open Golf Tournament,
Capati Dominga, age 25, nationality, Philippine, club affiliations, none. Occupation, washerwoman. The opening day of the tournament.
Up to the first tee steps Dominga Capati. Only native Philippine entry in the match. She tees up her ball, looks once down the fairway, swings.
The second day.
A cheering crowd is following Dominga Capati. Two strokes ahead of the field as she tees up for her 35th hole.
The final day.
Dominga Capati is four strokes ahead of her nearest competitor, socialite Jean Morgan, as she prepares to putt on the 72nd and final hole of the tournament.
Quiet, please. Quiet for Senorita Capati.
This week, new open golf champion of the Philippine Islands is washerwoman Dominga Capati, finishing five strokes ahead of her nearest rival. The first Filipino ever to win a golf championship. And at week's end, back at her washboard, says champion Capati,
I get driving muscles scrubbing up and down like this. And my wrist wringing out the clothes like this. And the putting, well, that just seemed to come natural.
1938. marches on. The USA, this week of 1938.
There is a new situation at sea which our nation can no longer ignore. That new situation involves the actions of three naval powers, Germany, Italy, and Japan. Against that new situation, the United States must be prepared with a navy second to none, with a train...
This week in Washington, testifying on behalf of the U.S. Navy, a gray-haired scholarly admiral sits in the witness chair before a House committee. He is William D. Lay, chief of operations of all the U.S. fleets. This week, putting the Navy on record for the first time in 22 years as naming a potential enemy of the United States on the high seas. In the hushed committee room, congressmen lean forward as committee members question the admiral.
Admiral Leahy, are you suggesting that the United States abrogate the 1936 London Naval Treaty?
The 1930 treaty allowed the United States and Great Britain five ships each to every three that Japan built. Japan, however, is reported to have exceeded the limit of the treaty of 1936.
So we must be armed 5-3 against Japan. Does it take five Americans to lick three Japs?
That, sir, is the first time I have heard such an expression.
Would you risk a fight with an equal Japanese navy?
I would be only too happy to take that chance.
Admiral Leahy, isn't there some sort of an understanding between the United States Navy and Great Britain?
Certainly not.
How does it happen that Captain Royal Ingersoll, chief of our Navy's War Council, has been carrying on consultations with the British Admiralty?
Mr. Chairman, I object to that question.
Oh, let him answer. Well, Admiral Leahy?
Gentlemen, I cannot answer that question at a public hearing. Its answer involves a matter of vital importance to the interests and defense of the United States.
But 24 hours after Admiral Leahy's refusal to answer the question of the U.S. Navy's secret business with the British Admiralty, from the office of Secretary of State Cordell Hull is issued a terse announcement.
After a long consultation, the government of the United States, together with the governments of Great Britain and France, has approached the Japanese government with a request for information regarding the Japanese naval building program. If no reply is received by February 20th, the United States, Great Britain, and France will consider themselves free to adopt naval armament plans without limitation.
Promptly on the floor of the United States Senate.
Mr. President, the Chief Admiral of the United States Navy speaks of Japan, Italy, and Germany as an alliance of enemy powers. We have seen our State Department act as if in alliance with Great Britain and France. I demand to know the meaning of this.
The Senator is jumping to conclusions, and I can assure the Senator on the word of the Secretary of State that we have not entered an alliance or combination of any kind with any foreign power.
Mr. President.
Senator from Idaho.
The important thing is that it looks as if we were allying ourselves against an enemy. And when other nations see that we are building a navy, the like of which has never been seen in time of peace, they can draw but one conclusion. These things cannot be whistled down the wind. These things lead to war.
Mr. President, the governments of Japan, Germany, and Italy are each and every one embarked on wars of conquest. If the democracies act together, there is nothing strange about it. As for the United States, we must be prepared without alliance to destroy any power that dares to attack us.
This week, no reply has come from the Japanese government to the arms ultimatum of the world's democracies. But unofficially, well knowing Japan's plans for 43,000-ton ships with 18-inch guns, the U.S., as of this week of 1938, has officially entered the world's armament race for the first time since the World War, with the greatest sustained naval building program in U.S. history. And this week, official Washington studies new results of the American Institute of Public Opinion's nationwide poll.
Tabulations received in our recent survey indicate that the American people are by overwhelming majority against war and against foreign alliances. Yet a majority of 74% of the American people favor a navy second to none.
Time marches on. On a morning a fortnight ago in the slum section of Birmingham, Alabama, a lanky, bareheaded Negro youth, a canvas under his arm, hurries into the open door of a small shanty.
Hey, Mom, where are you?
Coming, son. I'm coming.
Well, where are my paintbrushes? What'd you do with them?
Dan, Gustus, what's all the excitement about? What do you want with them brushes again?
You remember this picture I done called Morning?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to enter it in that competition they have them for young artists.
You going to do what?
That's right. Miss B had my picture hanging in the bookstore downtown. She said everybody liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know who said I should put my picture in the contest? Crawford Gillis.
Who's he?
Why, he's a big artist, Ma.
Augustus, that there exhibition is for white folks.
Oh, Ma, that don't matter. Not in something like painting.
Son, them white folks ain't gonna hang up a colored boy's picture. You know that.
Well, look at Paul Robeson, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, and Bill Robinson. Nobody cares what color they are. Or get my paints, Ma. I got work to do.
To Mr. Augustus Williams, dear sir, your entry number 230, titled Morning, has been accepted by the Women's Civic Club as a part of the Birmingham Division of the International Exhibition of Young Artists. The exhibition open to the public will be held at the Birmingham Public Library.
Promptly hung in Birmingham's public library is the picture Morning, landscape watercolor by young Negro Augustus Williams. Promptly next morning, off to see his picture hanging on exhibition, goes artist Williams. Returns an hour later to his home.
Well, Augustus, what did the folks say about your picture?
They liked it, Mom.
Is it got a lot of pictures hanging up there?
Not so many.
How'd yours look? Look good against the rest?
I guess so.
Augustus, what happened when you got there?
Nothing, Mom. The guard just said niggers weren't allowed. That's all.
This week, as the Birmingham Public Library enforces the old Jim Crow law of the South, refuses to permit Augustus Williams to see his own entry on exhibit, 15 Southern artists take up the cudgels for the young Negro painter. Letters pour into Birmingham's public library, some protesting that a Negro's picture was exhibited, most protesting that Jim Crow ruling. But comments librarian Lila Mae Chapman.
I didn't even know Augustus Williams had a picture on exhibition in our gallery. But we never have permitted Negroes to enter our library, and I don't see what we can do about it now.
1938 marches on. New York City.
The small businessmen of this country are going to Washington and make history. We're going to get a hearing. We're going to tell the president what's what. We're going to punch and punch hard. Holler and holler like hell.
Such this week is the battle cry of little clothing manufacturer Henry Sachs, one of 800 delegates to a conference of the nation's little businessmen, convening at the personal invitation of small business number one champion, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Declares little oil man, Alfred Mossman Landon,
those little fellows can give the president some good advice. They are the backbone of the nation.
Augurs Republican news pundit Mark Sullivan,
Mr. Roosevelt is at last looking for useful guidance.
Herbert Clark Hoover.
Small businessmen of the nation will bring to Washington that element of common sense and stability so desperately needed at the present time.
This week in Washington, on the platform of the Department of Commerce Auditorium, benignly beaming Secretary of Commerce Daniel Roper welcomes the delegates to the Conference of Little Businessmen.
I am proud to stand before this splendid group of American citizens. It is a privilege indeed to see with what genuine enthusiasm you have come together to offer your plans and advice. It is indeed an occasion which I shall long treasure among...
Louder!
Louder!
I can't hear you in the back.
I'm doing my best, but will you take your seat, please?
No, we won't take our seat. We came to be heard, not to listen.
Please, will you listen to me? I'm not going to make a speech. I merely want to suggest...
Down in front!
This is down in
take
front!
Seats.
We haven't had a prayer.
It's a monopoly!
Please, take your seat!
Second day of the little business conference.
Gentlemen, on behalf of the delegation from New York, I request that we get on with this day's business.
Who gave you the right to talk for New York?
What? Who gave New York a right to talk?
What?
New York thinks it's the whole United States.
Brooklyn! Brooklyn! Move them into the Brooklyn!
Brooklyn! New York!
Brooklyn!
Brooklyn! Brooklyn! New York!
Third day of the little business conference.
Mr. Chairman!
Order! Order! Sergeant at arms, throw that man out!
Free speech! Free speech! Let go of me! I demand a new group of my civil liberty! I demand a new home! I demand a new home!
But at week's end, little business gets down to serious business. Presents to Franklin Roosevelt its official 23-point program. Number 1 point in the program of little business.
Repeal of the corporate surplus tax.
Number 2 point.
Amendment of the Wagner Labor Relations Act.
Number 3 point.
Cheaper loans to small business for new plant and equipment.
Other points on the little business program. Federal economy. Social reform. Government hands-off business, big and small. And at week's end, comments New York Times correspondent Arthur Kroc.
The week had plenty of little laughs at the expense of little business. But the big laughs were on the big men who've been beating the drum for the little men. And the biggest laugh was on the big man who invited the little men to Washington, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Time marches on. Alcatraz Island. In the most grim and formidable of U.S. penitentiaries, one night this week, two guards approach the entrance to the cell block. Unlock and throw the heavy bolts. Roll back the massive steel door. Pause a moment on the threshold, then begin to walk slowly down the dimly lighted corridor towards the cell, which for 5 years has been occupied by prisoner number 85, Scarface Alphonse Capone.
Everyone's quiet except him.
Yeah, sounds cheerful enough.
I guess his troubles are over.
Number 85. Here we are.
All right, Capone. Got to come along with us now.
Yeah, you better quit singing, fella. Keep the others awake.
Nice song, huh?
Yeah. Come along now.
Come with you?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, but wait a minute.
What's the trouble?
My bed. I got to finish making my bed.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning.
I made it as good as I could, but there's always a wrinkle in it. I don't know.
Come on, Al. We'll send a guy down to fix your bed.
Okay. But I ought to smooth it out a little. Don't you think I ought to be before I go?
Twenty years ago, a swart, stocky Italian boy came out of Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and learned how to use a submachine gun on Chicago's South Side. Rode in an armored car, shot craps with $1,000 bills, sent floral tributes worth a fortune to the funerals of his victims, became the hero of short stories, movies, plays, the number one beer baron and big shot of the Prohibition era. This week, with eligibility for parole only 10 months away, into the hospital record at Alcatraz Prison goes the entry...
Number 85, Alphonse Capone, hallucinations and mental collapse.
Time marches on. Berlin, Germany. At 10 o'clock one night this week, over every radio in every home in Nazi Germany.
People of the Third German Reich, you are ordered to stand by your radios for important announcements concerning the government. Every German must give these announcements his complete attention. By order of the Fuhrer Adolf Hitler.
Such is the first hint to come to the German people of the events of a momentous week in Nazi German history. A week which brings to a climax the 5 years of growing friction between the Nazi political party of Adolf Hitler and old-line conservatives of the German army and aristocracy. A week which begins when into the private chancellery office of Adolf Hitler walk six Reichswehr generals, led by Chief of Staff Ludwig Beck and bemonocled Prussian Field Commander Werner von Frisch.
We have come to you on certain grave matters which concern not only the army, but all Germany, Reichsführer.
Of course, gentlemen.
The aid we have been giving to General Franco in Spain, Reichsführer.
Gentlemen, General Franco is combating the menace of Bolshevism, the greatest menace in the world today.
Reichsführer, we have much to lose in Spain, nothing to gain. We have drained the resources of the German army to help a doubtful cause. It is time to call a halt.
Is this the feeling of the army?
It is the feeling, Reichsführer, not only of the army, but of your ambassador to Austria, von Papen, your foreign minister, von Arad, of many of the highest men in the Third Reich.
So, von Papen, Neurath, I see.
The alliance with Italy. Again, we feel it is of doubtful value. And the persecutions of the church. In the past, the German people have fought and have suffered with faith in God. Germany cannot abandon that faith now.
We trust, Reichsführer, that some action may be taken on these matters as soon as possible.
And if such action does not meet with my approval?
In view of the feelings of the army, Reichsführer, we have every confidence that your approval will be granted.
One hour later comes the announcement that one of the rare meetings of Germany's parliament has been canceled. Throughout the night in Berlin embassies and diplomatic circles, through the offices of the great foreign press services, goes the word of a political crisis in the Third German Reich. Over all Germany descends a blank censorship of press and radio. Morning at a newsstand in the heart of Berlin.
London Times, please.
Here you are.
Have the Austrian papers come in yet?
No, not yet.
Swiss papers?
Not yet.
Stand aside, please.
What is an officer?
You will have to close your stand temporarily.
Close my stand?
Until we have confiscated your foreign newspapers. All foreign newspapers confiscated. Orders of the government.
All through the following night, lights blaze at the Chancellery. Chief of Police Heinrich Himmler comes and goes. 3 o'clock the next morning, the German embassy in Vienna, host of conservative aristocratic Franz von Papen.
Hello?
Berlin calling, Your Excellency. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello? Papen, this is Ribbentrop.
Oh, yes.
You are ordered to return to Berlin at once, Herr von Papen.
Return to Berlin? Hey, but Ribbentrop, I can do that only on the orders of the foreign minister.
I have just been appointed foreign minister by the Führer.
Yeah, but
you are hereby relieved of your post as ambassador to Austria, Herr von Papen. You will return to Berlin at once.
With the recall of Franz von Papen from Vienna, in the next 24 hours, recalled from Rome as Ambassador Ulrich von Hassel, recalled from Tokyo as Herbert von Dirksen. Late next night at the Berlin home of conservative army commander-in-chief Werner von Frisch.
Well, what is it?
I wish to see General von Frisch.
I'm very sorry, but the general has already retired for the night.
There's his room.
Down the hall on the right, but...
It's all right. Official business.
But you can't...
I tell you, it is official business.
Hello. Who is it?
Heinrich Himmler, chief of secret police.
Oh, yes, Herr Himmler.
Is there some word?
General von Frisch. By order of the Führer, I place you under arrest. You will remain here in quarters until further orders.
So at week's end, with the arrest of Werner von Frisch, conclude 6 days of virtual rebellion of conservative army officers against the authority of Adolf Hitler. Then the radio silence, which has blanketed all Germany, is finally broken by Minister of Propaganda, Paul Joseph Goebbels.
People of Germany, by order of Chancellor Adolf Hitler, the resignations of Defense Minister Field Marshal von Blomberg, of Army Commander-in-Chief General von Fritsch, of Foreign Minister Baron von Neurath, have been accepted. Foreign ambassadors to Rome, Vienna, and Tokyo have been recalled. The following changes in the economic ministry will become effective as of tonight.
In 6 days this week, Adolf Hitler completes a swift, secret purge of approximately 180 rebellious conservatives of the German army and diplomatic corps. In 1934, Adolf Hitler carried out an equally swift but bloody coup, which saw the execution of hundreds of his own Nazi party members. A purge followed 1 month later by the assassination of Austrian Chancellor Engelbert Dollfuss by Nazi agents. Followed 11 months later by the abrogation of the Versailles Treaty Clauses, which launched Germany on her program of rearmament. This week, whether the purge of 1938 presages new German adventures in Austria, in Czechoslovakia, in Spain, is known only to the Führer. And with rumors tonight of open revolt among officers and men of Berlin's crack Prussian regiments, only hint of the future course of German destinies is the statement to his people of Adolf Hitler.
Henceforth, I personally will exercise direct command of the entire armed establishment of the Third German Reich.
Time marches on. The pageant of the week's news. Memorable scenes from the news of the world you have followed tonight on the March of Time. It is this great news pageant of the world that the magazine Life is unfolding every week before the eyes of its readers in pictures.
Stories and pictures from the week's news front.
Only pictures could reproduce the now historic clash of personalities at the Washington Conference of Little Businessmen, where in two tempestuous days, the workings of pure democracy managed to produce a surprisingly forceful program. And only pictures could do justice to what is perhaps the greatest contrast in the week's news to the earnest brawling of America's little businessmen. The opening of Canada's parliament by her governor general, in all its ancient pomp and pageantry.
Life catches the news in the camera's eye.
In Life, you eyewitness the great murder trial of 1938, now in progress at Los Angeles, to which all Hollywood comes to watch the real life drama of a man fighting for his life. In Life, you watch all Egypt celebrate the marriage of its young king to his most beautiful subject. And in Life, you watch Japan's sacred Buddhist service of thanksgiving for the fall of Nanking.
Life takes you abroad.
In Life this week, you will see the almost unbelievable details of Europe's new world war of the airwaves. A war between fascism and democracy, in which the weapons are words and the battlefields extend to this country and to South America.
Life goes to the movies.
Life shows you what Hollywood is doing to make over the beautiful Robert Taylor into a he-man for masculine consumption.
And most timely and significant of all,
Life shows you the life and death of Abraham Lincoln. In a remarkable collection of 30 photographs, Life recreates a living record of the titanic struggle and tragic death of America's great president. You will be amazed, as Life was amazed, that such excellent photographs were taken so long ago. And in them, Life shows you Lincoln's second presidential campaign and inauguration, his meeting with McClellan at Antietam, making his deathless speech at Gettysburg, and the nation in mourning at his death. Every American man and woman and every growing American child will want to see these historic news photographs of Abraham Lincoln and his contemporaries, published in Life tomorrow, on the eve of the nation's celebration of his birthday on Saturday.
These are but a few of the week's news stories, which Life's new issue covers in words and pictures.
Be sure of getting a copy. Ask your news dealer for Life tomorrow, Friday morning. Time marches on.